Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. I've known the software we're about to talk about for years. What always gets me is, yeah, it's beautiful software. It really is amazingly created. But Jeroen Korthout, did I pronounce your name right?
Jeroen Korthout.
Okay, I wasn't too far off. He's a creator of Salesflare. They're an elegant, automated CRM for small businesses that are selling to businesses. It's really just well-organized and well-designed. The thing that gets me is we're dealing in a world with Salesforce. Dude, my three-year-old literally knows the Salesforce Tower here in San Francisco because you can't drive anywhere without seeing it, right? That Salesforce Tower was built because most people have a lot of money. Microsoft is in the space of creating these contact relationship management apps. There are tons of other apps that I'm not going to call out their names because then you're going to feel uncomfortable and say, why is Andrew talking about my competitors? But you know, they're out there. The thing that gets me is, how could this guy survive? How could he build a business with so much competition? And then what makes his software so different that people are signing up for it? That's what this interview is about. And for anyone out there who sees a product who says, I want to create something that's better and feels intimidated, I want this interview to come through for you. And we can talk about this success story here with Salesflare, thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first is called, well, it's not ClickFunnels so much. It's their podcast that you should be listening to after this interview is over, show you how to get traffic. It's called Traffic Secrets. And the second, if you're hiring developers, go to TopTal already. How many times do I have to keep telling you? TopTal. But I'll talk about those later. First, Jeroen, good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
I told you before we're going to started that I was going to ask you your revenue, and you said you were going to tell us what?
I was going to pass.
You're not going to tell us?
I always prefer people to think we're bigger than we are. I think we've built a brand and a nice product, and people are just going to be disappointed when they hear our revenue.
All right. Tell me about that time when you were working at your previous company, where the French team and the Dutch team were, what were they doing?
So yeah, previous to Salesforce, I was working at Across Health, which is a marketing consultancy and agency for pharma companies. Lots of big companies, you know. So we're approaching them from different countries. We were at a sales meeting. We had two of those every year. And we would go through the pipeline and our approach and this kind of stuff. And at some point, the French MD first, he said like, we're talking to this customer there about that. And then the Dutch team was like, really? We are actually doing the same thing, but over there. And then the other one was like, but it's not in Salesforce. And then the CEO would always say, like, what's not in Salesforce doesn't exist. And he would always joke, like, why is it called Salesforce? Because you have to force salespeople to fill it out. he would very much do that with us. Always make these rules about stuff we have to do, or quota for how many calls we had to put in so that we put in that exact amount of calls. That never really worked. And it also never really worked for me as a practical sales tool. The first thing that struck me was you had opportunities and you had leads. And I tried to have someone explain how a lead turned into an opportunity. And there was nobody that could give me like a uniform answer. So I was always very confused about that part. And for instance, I was using Wunderlist for my tasks. Salesforce was just like a super complex thing that would only remind me within Salesforce, while Wunderlist was this nice and clean things that I could feel, and I would scratch it off and it would feel good. And I would get notifications everywhere. And I was so confused about how can this be that this huge company has such a bad experience when it comes to, I mean, something that I find core to what they do.
You know, when Lyft came out with their Lyft Pool or Lyft Line, whatever it is, where multiple people can get in a ride together. I said, let's try it. I'm living in San Francisco to see people. Let's see people. And so I get in a car and somehow we get into a conversation where the guy tells me that he's a salesperson at Salesforce. I said, oh, good. Can I see how you manage your Salesforce? And he showed me the app, full of pride, beaming, explaining all the different aspects of it. I get how everything was there, but I also have to say everything was there. It was just way too overwhelming. There's no app that I enjoy using that's that crazy overwhelming. And so I get it. And you said, look, first of all, we're being forced to use it because it's not easy and we shouldn't be forced to do manual typing work for the company. And number two, if somebody misses an opportunity or misses typing something in, you have a situation like you guys had where two different departments were talking to the same company and neither one of them knew about it. And you said, there's got to be a better way. At what point did you take the leap from saying, there should be a better way than this, to, I think we could do it?
The very moment that this happens, like we were working, fast forward, we're working on a business intelligence software company. We have a lot of leads trying to follow them up. And it was sort of a big pain. But when that was something we felt. But then when the actual trigger happened was when we did our first newsletter for that company. We did in MailChimp. And I showed my co-founder, like, look, you can see when these people open the email, when they click on the email, all this kind of stuff. And he was all stupefied by this. He was like, really? That's possible? And how does that work? I'm like, it's this little pixel and then this in-between link and stuff. He was like, oh, that's amazing. And you can track emails. We could also pull in emails so you don't have to track them in the CRM anymore. And the same is probably possible with the calendar, and we could do something with phones. So we could build this system that tracks the whole conversation you're having with a company just automatically. Every single touch point will be mapped out for you as a salesperson.
Sorry to interrupt. You're saying MailChimp did this in an automated way? And if they're doing this little bit of automation, it's not like the reader has to tell the company that sent out the message, I read your email. It's just automatically tracked and you can automatically do follow-ups on it. You said, I think we could do the same thing for CRM, right?
For sales, yeah. And that's actually one of the reasons we chose the name SalesFlare, is that we said there's so much marketing automation and data collection and all that. Why don't we do that for sales? And our very initial idea was to make, instead of a marketing automation platform, to make a sales automation platform, a sales platform.
What did you imagine you were going to automate?
All the stupid data input you had to do, we would automate for you. So as a salesperson, you would hate working with Salesforce, no problem. Next to Salesforce, we would put this magical sales platform that would take care of all the sales stuff for you, and it would integrate with Salesforce and sync everything back. That was our initial idea.
You were just going to be the automation layer on top of Salesforce, almost removing the force you had to put data into Salesforce.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. And so the first step you took was what? Apparently you got together in an old bank building? Doing what?
Basically tinkering with our software, tinkering with how we would make this. But the first thing we said when we had this idea and it started growing on us and we started having like sitting together about it and with a beer, and we were like, if we want to do this seriously, we need to raise money, because otherwise we will never get detached from our jobs. We will never have the time to spend on this. So we were looking around and we found this thing called Kima 15. That was a program that back in the day Kima Ventures had. Kima 15 doesn't exist anymore, but their offering was very enticing to us, because in 15 days, we would know whether they would give us $150,000 or euros, I think, for 50% of our company. It was dollars?
Yeah, their plan, from what I could see here in an old tech.eu article, was Kima Ventures was going to invest $150,000 for a 15% stake in a company, and they would close the deal in 15 days. And they were planning on doing this for 50 startups within a year. And you saw that and you said, I think we could be a part of this. And you went to their website and you said, what do we need to do in order to make this work, right?
Yeah, they advertised that they wanted to have, I don't remember how they phrased it, lean companies that operated according to the philosophy set out in Getting Real by 37 Signals.
That's what they wanted. They said, here's the Getting Real philosophy. Please follow that.
Yeah.
And had you read that book? That's by the creators of Basecamp.
I had not before. No.
Okay.
Yeah. We immediately downloaded it. I started reading it. Levin started reading it. We went through that and we thought that all makes so much sense. And what they advocated was not to immediately start building the whole thing, but to start small. So the things we planned was, one, I was going to make a presentation, an investor deck that we were going to send to Kima, which would have all the proper investor deck slides. And he was making a prototype, something we could show them to show what we had in mind, and that we could show other people to show what we were working on. Something that didn't do anything at all. So imagine a flat HTML where you could do some clicks, and that was it.
All right. So you created it. You started to show it to people. What was the feedback you got?
Some very positive feedback, like, oh my God, I so need that. Other companies we went to were very much like, but is it going to do that? I don't know whether you know a lot of Belgian people, but we tend to be very conservative about things and very skeptical. So we got a lot of these skeptical questions in many different directions, which often sort of threw us off. It was not an easy start in that sense.
I just interviewed Jason Fried, the creator of Basecamp, the author of that book. And as part of my process of getting to know him, I went back and I read the transcripts of interviews that I've had with him over the last decade. He's one of the people who I've interviewed the most. And I think you weren't doing his book right. He believed in just create something simple, but create it fully and launch it. It's the lean startup, Eric Ries, who has the different approach, which is start small, get feedback, keep improving. Jason Fried would have been horrified, I think, if you took your first version of your slides and asked people for feedback, because I think he would have been he would have been able to anticipate the kind of overwhelm that you felt, that too many people want too many things and it's not your project anymore. And I could see now why he'd be so opposed to that.
That is very possible. I really have to read the book again, Getting Real. I also did an interview with him a few weeks ago for my podcast, but I didn't read Getting Real. I went more into things like Rework and stuff. I have no idea. It could be that you're right.
He does believe, and that book is still so good. I feel like it's one of the most underestimated books in tech because it's an older book, and a lot of the ideas in there are now obvious. But he said, start simple, build simple, remove features, make decisions for your customers, have an opinion, hold back some big features, and don't worry, it's going to be okay, because then when you launch those big features, you're going to have a thing to take out to the media and say, this big feature is now added. And so instead of adding it all at once and having it all go to waste, wait, go smaller, do well. All right, I got to tell you about a company called TopTal. Have you heard about TopTal?
I've heard about it many times on your podcast.
One of my other listeners is a guy named Enrique. He said, I don't have a big budget. I do need to have a developer, but what he wanted was not a full-time developer, but a developer that he can just kind of call on and ask for help whenever he needed it. And so he went to TopTal whenever he needs a project done quickly and his team doesn't have the time to do it. He calls up the person at TopTal, says, we're ready to hire you. Here's the discrete project that we need you to do. And he says that person can develop for them a project that would take days for his team to do in about a day and a half. So instead of a week or two, you're now down to a day or two for creation of it. Anyone out there who's listening to me who needs to hire developers, you can hire full-time, part-time, whole teams of developers at once, all from TopTal. That's top as in top of your head, tal as in talent, TOPTAL. And if you go to toptal.com/mixergy, they'll give you 80 hours of developer credit in addition to a no-risk trial period. When you pay for your first 80 hours, go take a look at the details on the site. That's toptal.com/mixergy, TOPTAL.com/MIXERGY. So with all the features that people were throwing at you, what did you end up creating?
Oh, well, at that moment, we weren't creating yet, but it sort of threw us into an identity crisis. Also because we joined an accelerator. And in that accelerator, we had a lot of mentor sessions. I think we got about 80 people telling us what they wanted. And on top of that, I was doing customer interviews. So it started shifting what we wanted to build. And it's only after, I think, a few months at least, that we said, okay, now we need to hold back, think back about what we were actually thinking to create, and then go with that. We only started developing about 4 or 5 months in. That's when we started actually developing the product.
And that's when you said, what do we want, when you went back to you and your needs and your experiences?
Indeed.
And so what did the first version look like based on that?
The very first version was basically an Outlook plugin and a mobile app, which was about the same thing. And it only had the email integration. So it basically make a timeline of all the emails you're exchanging with a certain person. And it worked like this. If you went to an email in Outlook, it would show you all the emails you would have exchanged earlier with that person. And people were like, how is this useful? Like, I have an email here and I see more emails there, but what do I do with it? And that's because the minimum viable product, let's say, was a bit too minimum viable at that point.
Okay. So then what did you do next?
Next, we started thinking, how can this make more sense? So we switched what was shown next to the email. We started showing information about the company that it detected in the email. And for that, we started building out a sort of system in which it would say, this is a contact, and that contact has that email address, so then it must be working at that company. So we pull up information about that company, add it next to the email, like the logo, the name, the size of the company, the website, all this kind of stuff. We suggested a contact. You could create it in one click, add the contact in one click, and then you would have the timeline with emails. And that already started making way more sense, because then it started behaving more and more like what you'd expect from a CRM, is that you have customers and a timeline and contacts and their details and all these kind of things.
Where'd you get all that data about the company?
We started pulling in mainly data from full contact for the companies. And we still do that today. So if you
through
get a Salesforce subscription, through their API, yeah. If you start a Salesflare subscription, you get basically full contact data included.
Oh, I didn't realize that. But yeah, full contacts is really nice because all they do is enrich address book data. So I can plug in my iPhone address book and suddenly there'd be photos of the people who are in my address book. There's links to the LinkedIn profiles, their Twitter accounts, their GitHub, and a little bit of extra data. And so you were able to do that for each person in the person's email. But still, we're not getting to the Salesforce integration, which seemed like your original idea.
That's something we would build afterwards. But while we were having all these discussions with bigger companies, it became more and more clear that they were opposed to the idea of having data in two places. They were like, okay, so you can have data in a sales platform, you can have data in a CRM, and we don't like that because we don't think the sync is gonna work well. We want everything in Salesforce.
But isn't that the original idea? You're going to take all the information from their email, put it into Salesforce, all the information from everywhere and connect it into Salesforce automatically?
We saw it as two systems. So a sales platform and a CRM synced up. At that point, there were other companies in the market like Brisk.io of Hampus Jakobsen, if you've ever heard of them. They were building an interface on top of Salesforce. But we saw that as a way too complicated and journey that would not end up well. And I think a year later or something, Brisk also stopped with this.
Why? Why didn't that make sense? It does feel like Salesforce is so complicated. A simplification layer on top of it might make sense.
The problem you end up with there is one of mismatched expectations. A Salesforce environment is fully custom. You can change anything there. So the integration with it is already sort of difficult because things might be different everywhere. But what people expect from their Salesforce environment is also that they just get consultants and they customize it. If you're going to build a product, basically a sidebar on top of Salesforce, people start having the same expectations. And that's where Brisk.io got into problems, because they started customizing their product for every single big client that they had, and it started becoming a mess.
All right, so I'm with you. And at some point you say, we're going to create our own CRM, our own like competitor Salesforce, but a lot simpler. How'd you do that?
Yeah, we basically were on a dead track with all these mid-sized companies that we were talking to about Salesforce. They had an issue, but they didn't believe in the way we saw the solution. And then we talked to a lot of companies around us. We were in a startup incubator, and they were all like, what you built is cool. I want that. And we're like, okay, that is possible, but then we're not going to be a sales platform. Then we're actually going to be a CRM. And then we have some more work to add lots of CRM features. But it might be a better avenue because we can actually build a better thing than what's on the market. Back then, there was a very stark difference between us and competing products, because the competing products, HubSpot and Pipedrive, mostly Pipedrive actually in the beginning, they were like not just a little bit manual, they were super manual. Nowadays, they have built in some integrations to automate some of the data input, there's still not platforms that really build on top of existing data.
What they do now is you still manually put in the data, but they will connect, say, to your email. And if you've had an email conversation or someone else in your team has had an email conversation with the contact, they'll pull it into their CRM.
Yeah.
Okay. How long did it take you to create your first version of SalesFlare the way it is now, as a standalone CRM that people can go into and add their leads and use to close sales?
That's a very hard question because there have been so many versions, obviously. Our very first version that we could show to people took 3-4 months. The very first version that someone else would use, not only me, would be like 7-8 months or something.
Okay.
And the first version that somebody actually wanted to pay for took about a year.
Oh, wow. And this was Levan who was creating it?
It was Levan together with Adri. We actually, when we got in this startup accelerator, we had 25K and we figured, my God, that's a lot of money. We can hire someone. So we did that. And he's still with us, actually, after all these years, after five years now.
So Kima Ventures, with their Kima 15, you didn't end up working with them and giving them 15%. Why not?
We sent them all these things and they came back pretty quickly saying that we were a bit too early stage, which I understand now.
All you had was PowerPoint. But
yeah,
they did tell you what you needed to get done, and using them as an outside motivator got you to get going and start creating. What's the accelerator that did take you in then?
We actually got in two. One was more of an incubator. It was started at KBC. It's by a very big bank in Belgium. And we also got in an actual accelerator, which was called back then Telenet ID Labs. It was organized by one of the biggest telecom operators of Belgium. And within that program, we got some money and we got a lot of workshops and mentorship and all these kind of things.
So you built the first version, you were using it yourself. And I guess you were paying yourself a little bit of a salary as you were waiting for that full year to finish when you got your first customer, right?
Yeah, after a while. In the beginning, we didn't pay ourselves a salary, but after a while, our bank accounts started going down and down and we had to pay ourselves some.
And you were living off of your savings?
I had a little bit of savings.
What type of a saver are you? I think most people are not savers at all.
It's hard to say because I've been now working on Salesforce for a long while, paying myself little and saving little and paying off a nice apartment here. So I honestly have no idea myself. When I was still working at Across Health, I was building up money quite well, but now I always stay around the same level.
I thought I was a big saver, but I don't think I am now. If I look back in retrospect, COVID has made me a much better saver. I'll give you an example. We went camping this past weekend. I took 3 hot water bottles. One of them had coffee, one had tea, and the other just had plain hot water so I could add whatever I want for the drive. In the past, I would have pulled over 4 times to get coffee or to get something on the way over to this campground that was about 3 hours away. That's just now a natural for me. I never understood when people did that because who cares? It's just a couple of bucks. But now I'm noticing it's a couple of bucks here and there. It definitely adds up. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of time wasted. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Especially with COVID, I think it was very easy to not spend on restaurants and trips and all these kind of things. And I've personally definitely felt that in my bank account.
Me too. Fewer restaurants. You know, I remember the founder of WP Beginner. Mm-hmm. He's bought a bunch of real estate. He's really well off now. When I first interviewed him, I think he was just a kid getting started with this blog. Now he's got all kinds of software and the blog. But when we had lunch, he told me, Andrew, yeah, I'm buying buildings, but I refuse to buy Netflix. I go, what do you mean? I don't think I'm talking out of school here, but he says, I don't think you should spend money on Netflix. I go, so you don't watch anything of this? My gardener told me that he had Netflix. I said, okay. I said, can I just be on your Netflix account? Gardner said, sure, why not? I get lots of profiles. So he's on like his gardener's profile, something like that. If it's not his gardener, it might be his housekeeper or something. And at the time, it seemed so small. Who cares? Just a couple of bucks. Now I'm telling you, I see through COVID, it adds up.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not helping my business or helping my kids get smarter, what's the point? I got enough entertainment in my life. I got enough stuff. All right, let me take a moment to talk about, since I've been talking a lot, I might as well tell everybody about my second sponsor. It is a company called ClickFunnels. And if you're out there listening to me, we're about to talk about how to get traffic, how it is at Salesforce, like that alliteration?
I cannot comment because their lawyers will come after me.
So. They really would. My guess is it was an accident. It wasn't intentional. And then it just kind of sounded nice. And now you get the benefit of it, but you're right to be afraid.
Yeah. We have brand protection. So the USPTO thinks it's distinguishable enough. I must say the way we came with it was, as I said, we were looking to build a sales tool. So we were very clear on sales. And now I was looking for .coms. And Sales Flare sounded interesting. It sounded good.
It is good.
And the idea we had, like the very philosophical description, was we were going to throw a flare in the black box of sales.
Yeah, the flare of light to make it easier for people to see, be the guy who's helping navigate them. In my mind, it was Sales Flare as in like all the little flare, which is, I forget, what is it, an Office Space or something, where flare is the stuff that you have on your shirt at a restaurant, on your jacket to just make it more interesting. I thought it was like that. It's like all the little details that make the contact record more meaningful. All right. I had a different vision for it. You know what? Before we get into the ClickFunnels spot where I tell people to go and sign up for Traffic Secrets, their podcast, let's talk about your first customer and then I'll get into it. How did you get your first customer?
Our first customer was a Dutch company. They contacted us in the summer of 2015. And they had read about us in MarketingFacts.nl. We had gone to some little conference and there was a journalist on MarketingFacts.nl and he was like, oh, it's really interesting what you're doing. So he wrote an article about us and this guy had read it and he came to us and he said, I read that you are building a CRM that sort of lives by itself. And that's really something I have an issue with because we have Microsoft Dynamics here at the company. And it really does not work for my salespeople. They don't fill it out. No data comes in it. And as I understood it, your system actually automates that. It's going to make it work. And he was a typical Dutch guy going straight at the solution, being very simple about it. And he said, if you can make this work, we'll sign up. And he just went for it. A company with zero track record. He said, this, and this, I'll pay you. And then so we were very thankful to have these first guys because that's started to get the ball rolling.
And he found you because of that article on you.
Yeah.
Got it. He wasn't the person who was writing the article.
No.
Oh, got it. So basically somebody who exactly fit the profile that you were looking for, someone who wanted to get data in without the work of putting it in. All right. So come back to my first sponsor. If you're out there and you're trying to get traffic to your site, trying to get traffic to your work, trying to get somebody to pay attention to what you've built, you've got to check out Traffic Secrets. It's a podcast by Russell Brunson, the creator of ClickFunnels. He's so good at getting traffic. I've seen him for freaking years. But I go into Instagram. Of course, he's there on Instagram. He's got photos of his kids doing trampoline. He's got photos of him and his wife when they were first getting married. He's got photos of sales presentations, all kinds of stuff. I'm going over to ClickFunnels again, even though I've been on ClickFunnels forever. I go to YouTube. He's the guy on YouTube who just keeps sucking me in with ads for his book. And so I end up going and checking out his book and getting his book. He's a guy who Facebook. I feel like anything that I do online, Russell Brunson and his team find a way to get my attention there. And so instead of going, well, why is this guy following me? I think the better question is, how is he doing it? And the better question than that is, how can we do it? Well, guess what? He created a podcast where he tells you what he does. He gives you the secrets that have helped him get traffic to his site, which then allowed his software to get more and more customers. If you want to get more traffic to your site, if you want more people to pay attention to what you're doing, you got to get the secret. It's called Traffic Secrets. It's a podcast available for free in whatever podcast app you're listening to me on. So go look for Traffic Secrets right now. Do you listen to podcasts?
I do. I listen to yours.
You do? Thank you. What do you look for in what do you look for in the Mixergy podcast?
Good guests, interesting interviews. It's mostly the interesting interviews. I mean, getting good guests is not difficult. Actually pulling out a great story is more difficult. And I think you do this really well.
For me, I realized that as a podcast listener, what I'm kind of looking for is almost company through my day. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So if we don't have a cleaning person now, and so if I'm organizing something in the house, I don't want to just do it by myself. I'll hit play and I'll listen to a podcast. If I cycled into our interview right here, I don't want to just cycle. I want to listen to a podcast. My problem is that all the podcasts end up going back to Trump and politics, which at some point just weighs me down. And I got it. I know the message. So for the first time, I listened to music on the way into work today. I just couldn't find one podcast that got away from the negativity. I found one on WeWork. It's a multi-part podcast on WeWork. I thought they'd examine what didn't go well at WeWork and what did go well. Let's learn from their success, right? They did something, yeah, right? I'm not saying they're a great company. I'm saying they did something right. The whole podcast is, look at how they're manipulating their people. Look at how they're not handling the vomit in the phone booths, right? Look at how they forgot to pay for a bathroom. I get it. Quit bringing me down. I feel like we're going through tell me if you think this right. I feel like we're going through a period right now where things are bad economically, things are bad health-wise, where things are bad. And so the thing to do now is to create complainy podcasts, complainy articles, complainy tweets, complainy, like be the person who reflects back to the world the anguish and frustration that they have, and they're going to like you. But that might be great for getting people to pay attention. It's a horrible thing to put out in the world. I just can't deal with it myself as a consumer.
Yeah, I personally have never listened to complaining podcasts. I don't see myself doing that. Complaining articles, I sometimes stumble upon them. And sometimes, like yesterday, some article pointed me to the fact that there is a Facebook group in Belgium called, I'm going to translate it, No Against 1.5 Meter. So I thought, oh, I'm going to go have a look what that means. I guess it's 6 feet in the US. And it was horrible. Jesus, the stuff I saw there. I cannot unsee. It's just
like what'd you see?
And people put up all these, for instance, the anti-vax thing is coming up a lot recently. So they have these things like aluminum in this is wrong. Aluminum in vaccines is right. And then they say, can this be right?
Without context. Right. If we won't allow aluminum in these other products, why are we allowing it in our body? Yeah. You know what? We are really at a point where I could even see it in the tech press. There's no optimism. There's no hope. There's no, here's the amazing thing that's being built. It's just this sense of helplessness that Amazon is going to take over everything. And I don't get me wrong. I do see problems here. We definitely have companies that are way too big. We definitely have competition that's way harder than it used to be, but it's not helpful. I get it. I understand it. I got the policy. I think I know how I can vote. I know how I'm going to vote. Great. Now, what do I do tomorrow? What do I do today when I come into the office? Fire me up with some optimism. Give me some opportunity. Yeah. Show me what's there. All right. Speaking of, you got your first customer. Give me some optimism. How'd you get the next batch of customers? What worked for you?
Yeah, we have a lot of content about this online, but the very initial ones were all network, literally all.
You mean you personally reaching out to people?
Me personally reaching out to people, mostly people I would even know. That's in the beginning, the only thing that really, really worked because we were a small company. We had nothing. So yeah, what do you do? And actually I did a survey last year in a big group of SaaS companies and everybody had that answer. Like it was the big, how do you get from 0 to 100 customers? Network. You just talk to a lot of people.
You're saying the very first 100 customers was not from you getting more blog posts, which worked for you for getting the first customer, but emailing people, contacting them, saying, do you want to try my software?
Yeah. Oh, actually,
give me an example.
We didn't start blogging until beginning of 2017 or end of 2016. Okay. I always kept blogging away. For me, blogging was, it's cool. I mean, we're writing stuff, but it's not going to bring us customers now. So I never touched it. We didn't have a blog at all for 2.5 years or something.
So give me an example of a friend or a contact that you reached out to and converted.
There were some in the startup incubator that we were in. We would often show people what we were working on and they would be like, this looks great. How far is this and can we try it? And actually, my whole process would be taking people by the hand, like over Skype or Zoom or whatever, showing them a demo. They would be like, oh, that looks great. Then like, oh, should we install this for you? Our email integration was not as seamless as it was today. You had to fill out a lot of IMAP details and all. So I'd take them by the hand there. and show them the products, get them all the way through, really fully guided. There was no sense of what it is today that you just click, connect your email and starts running for you and everything starts working. It was all manual.
You know, Rahul from Superhuman did that with me. We're talking about after he had tons of customers, he insisted on personally showing me and setting me up with Superhuman. And because I used an iPad as my main computer, he just kept taking notes. And he said, Andrew, let's be honest, here are our problems with iPad. We actually don't prioritize it. And now I get it. I feel like at some point you're going to see full-on Chrome and other apps on this. So I could understand why he didn't. But he just kept taking notes on what was working, kept telling me what he knew was going to fire me up. And I could see how it helped make the product better. But it also helped me have a much better Superhuman experience. So you kept doing that one-on-one. Wasn't it frustrating? Isn't it a downer to see somebody try to use your software and not have it work, or they bring their skepticism? I find the best customers often are the most skeptical too.
Yeah, it's both an upper and a downer, I'd say. Because one, you're getting someone on your software, yay. And second, you're there for every embarrassing moment that indeed you get to write down neatly, bring it back to the developers, start prioritizing. And that's actually why you should do it. It's to see everything that goes wrong, because it's only like that you can fix it. And if you just take a product, launch it online, put some Hotjar in there to follow what they were doing, you will not get the same feedback. You will not understand all the pains people are going through in the process of getting on your product and getting to know it.
What'd you do to deal with the overwhelm and to keep yourself feeling positive as you were going through all these problems?
Overwhelm. We track issues in GitHub. We started building a system there over time on how to prioritize things there, how to keep positive. Yeah, I guess that's the overall thing with being an entrepreneur. It's every day you just need to go on. But like I said, getting people on the product itself was already, felt good.
Just to see somebody use the product.
But yes, and if they would be excited about it and really use it, they would be like, yes, we're building something that is like worth it. People are using it. People are liking it more over all these big other things you have out there.
Yeah, let's talk about then Salesforce and all the other companies out there that are in the CRM space. Full Contact has their own CRM, even as they're supporting you, right?
Full Contact has a sort of contact manager, which they're currently divesting. But yes, there's about 650 CRMs out there, I think.
Yeah. So how do you compete in a world with that many CRMs?
It is very difficult. What we compete on is mostly what you just mentioned with Superhuman, is to be closer to customers, understand them better. And apart from that, just doing things better than others would. Like if we write content marketing, there's no copywriter writing up something they wrote and they read on other blogs or something. It's actually us trying to create something valuable. Always.
You're saying the way you compete with them is by being more personal, more hands-on?
Yes.
What's your email address? Can you give that out?
It's Jeroen@salesflare.com.
So just first name at salesflare.com for anyone who wants to reach out to you. And do you still do customer demos?
I still do customer demos. I try to be slightly selective, of course, with my time because I only have so much time in a day. So usually I pick out the slightly bigger ones. But what I do also is I connect with every single person who gets on our software on LinkedIn. And if the first step obviously goes automated, I'm not there looking for everyone on LinkedIn. But then when they accept it, I start a conversation and I try to understand what they're looking for, how it's going, how the first impressions are.
On LinkedIn is how you're messaging your customers?
So we have in the software, we have Intercom. And with Intercom, we do all the usual support and the email follow-up and all that. But next to that, I'm also connecting with people on LinkedIn. Yeah.
Wow. Because I guess your customers are business people, so they're using LinkedIn chat a lot.
Yeah.
I get so overwhelmed by LinkedIn chat because so many people add me that I just can't handle all the automated messages in there. But I do see that people are actually using it. They're sending me personal messages. But in addition to it, I also definitely see these automated messages in here. I can tell.
Yeah. Well, the LinkedIn connection request is something you just scroll through and be like, oh, this person actually I know. And then you accept.
I do them all. I just say yes to every single one of them.
Oh God.
Yeah. Well, yeah, now it's a little bit of a problem. But I feel like it helps. They're basically giving me their contact information. So I might as well take it from there. And that way if I ever need to reach them for something, I could get them.
You don't get again, contact information anymore. LinkedIn stopped that. So you cannot even export the email addresses of your LinkedIn contacts anymore.
Yeah, and plus, you know what? We use a service that get Headreach that gives us email addresses. Yeah. So if we ever need an email, we just do that. Yeah, so maybe I should just go in and start deleting anyone who I don't know. I did that on Twitter. It was incredibly helpful. There was some iPhone app that unfollowed everybody. Once I did that and started to just more intentionally follow people, it became a lot more useful in there. Yeah, so that's what you LinkedIn. Do. So everyone who's on LinkedIn is somebody who you're somehow connected to, who's a customer of yours, your business prospect, it seems like.
Not
you.
Necessarily. Me going outbound, it can be automated. People reaching out to me, I will only accept people that I want to connect with. You have founder on your profile on LinkedIn. If you do that, you just get overwhelmed with so many connection requests of either people who want to build software for you, people who want to write content for you, people who want to whatever, anything.
For me, it's people. It looks like this guy, Dylan Mentor, wants to be a guest on my podcast, I guess. Or maybe, no, he wants to show me that he did a podcast with somebody who I did a podcast with, I guess. It's so weird when somebody is trying to get a single listen by messaging me. Oh, here's another one, Kimberly Line. It looks as though we have a lot of commonality in our professional lives and connections, and I thought it would be great to have you as part of my LinkedIn network. Thanks, Kim. I'm not sure what to do with it. That's why, to me, LinkedIn is
also...
LinkedIn seems like a waste. So why do you use LinkedIn instead of just emailing people or texting them or something?
Because LinkedIn, there are two reasons. One, you can chat with them, and chat is so much better than email. You can have an actual conversation.
Is
while
it
email
real time?
Is very, like, goes back and forth, takes a while, there's a big distance. Secondly, I also have a lot of stuff on LinkedIn. So these people also get to see these things. So it helps also build a connection with the customer that is more personal and more than it would be like me sending them an email, which they would assume is automated as well. So.
All right. What else? Let's close it out with one more thing that you do to get customers. What's worked?
What has worked mostly for us is writing content next to the whole word of mouth. The latest approach we take there is we write about a topic in a better way than we can find on other blogs. Okay. Really targeted at the search intent, but also making it interesting in such a way that we can share it on social media.
I saw Ahrefs talked about that. They said, look at who's sending traffic to your competitors or what pages on your competitors' sites are doing well. If you can do better than them, do that. And that's
we do a very similar thing to Ahrefs. Yeah.
Okay. What software do you use for that?
Ahrefs.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
All right. And if I'm going to look at SimilarWeb to see where you get your traffic. Oh, man. You're not buying ads, right?
Not much.
No, just all contact. Organic search is really big for you. Oh, I see. About 3.22% comes from paid search ads. The rest is all organic. All right. For anyone who wants to go check it out, the website is salesflare.com. I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first, if you're out there and hiring developers, you should check out toptal.com/mixergy will get you 80 hours of developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And second, if you're done with this and you're ready for your next podcast, go listen to Traffic Secrets. It's all about the secrets for getting traffic to your site, getting traffic to your content, getting traffic to your online store. Traffic Secrets. Thanks. Thanks, everyone.